If I told you that every man, woman, and child living and working in Canada will be donating $15 each to the Republican Party, headed by George W. Bush in the United States, to help them in their 2006 re-election campaign, you might not believe it. As it turns out, Canadians are going to be transferring about $450 million into an escrow account run by George W. Bush and the White House to be used for meritorious purposes through a key article in the recent softwood lumber deal worked out between Canadian and U.S. negotiators. To learn more about this issue, I phoned Elliot Feldman. He's a lawyer with the firm Baker & Hostetler in Washington, D.C. He's a former director at the Canadian-American Business Alliance and has been watching this issue closely since 1989. He began by giving me a brief recent history of the softwood lumber dispute.
The lumber dispute between Canada and the United States is a fundamental dispute about the way, about the relationship between government and natural resources, and the difference between public and private sectors. In the United States, there's an assumption that natural resources should be privately owned and traded in open markets. In Canada, there's a patrimony. There's a long history of natural resources being owned and controlled by provincial governments. Indeed, it's inscribed in the Canadian Constitution that way. And so roughly 97% of Canadian forest resources are in public hands, whereas in the United States, at least 70% are in private hands. The United States has objected for over 30 years now that the Canadian way of doing things is not acceptable, that because of government ownership, there is an inherent subsidy in the way in which Canadian governments make the natural resource of standing timber available to the private sector. That's the core of the dispute, and it's such a fundamental disagreement about the way government should work and the relationship to natural resources that in many respects it seems perpetually irresolvable. And so we've had a series of disputes. Each one gets a Super Bowl number. Lumber 1 was back in 1981. Lumber 2 in 1986. Lumber 3 in 1996, actually in 1991 is when it started, and we're in the midst of Lumber 4. Much of the industry and the Canadian government fears and speaks of an inevitability of Lumber 5. I personally am not in the Lumber 5 school. I don't believe Lumber 5 will happen, but I'm in a distinct minority in that regard. So that's the broad history of the dispute and what it's about. The current dispute began really by going back to Lumber 3. In Lumber 3, Canada won a complete legal victory under NAFTA. It was the first time that NAFTA had been in place when a lumber claim had been made by the United States against Canada. And it went through NAFTA panels. In fact, they were then free trade agreement panels, prior to NAFTA. Canada won a complete victory, but the United States refused to return Canada's money that had been collected illegally. And as part of a compromise, Canada promised that it would enter consultations with the United States toward finding a long-term resolution of the dispute. And in partial but unofficial exchange, the United States agreed to give back Canada its money. That led to the Softwood Lumber Agreement, the SLA, which had a 5-year term and was a quota on Canadian exports to the United States. That quota was highly restrictive, and over time, and not over a lot of time, 2 or 3 years in, it became apparent to Canadian industry that it was unfair and detrimental to the industry. And so there was a growing disaffection at the idea that the agreement would be extended or even modified, and it expired of its own weight after 5 years. The U.S. industry was poised to launch another complaint, which it did immediately upon expiration, within 24 hours, and pressed hard to reimpose duties on Canadian exports to the United States at exceedingly high rates because of a theory that had been pressed previously but always rejected, that U.S. prices and Canadian prices could be compared directly without taking account for the fact that in Canada, the industry pays virtually all of its own expenses. It pays for fire protection. It pays for insects and disease in the trees. It builds its own roads, but deeds them over to provincial governments. So the governments own the roads, but they're built at the expense of industry. Industry is expected to maintain the roads on behalf of the provincial governments and make them available for uses beyond simply bringing down timber. All of those expenses that are carried by Canadian industry are not carried by U.S. industry on U.S. public lands. In the U.S. public forests, county, state, and federal, the governments pay for all of those things. So when you take just the price of standing timber and try to compare it, you don't ever have a fair comparison. But the United States insisted on applying that theory and so arrived at a very high subsidy, an alleged subsidy for Canada, and therefore very high tariff rates, which were onerous, and bled the Canadian industry of its profits immediately. When that occurred, the Bush administration had just come in 2001, and it had a political agenda that made it completely susceptible to the interests and demands of the U.S. industry. So whereas previous administrations, going back to the Reagan administration, had rejected the U.S. theory that you could make a direct comparison of these prices, the Bush administration accepted the theory and therefore imposed the highest tariffs we've ever seen on softwood lumber. The reason the Bush administration did that was that the president had highest on his trade agenda a need for passage by Congress of what he called trade promotion authority, what had previously been called fast track authority. Trade promotion authority is an authority conferred on the president whereby when he enters a trade agreement with a foreign country, Congress is permitted only to vote it up or down but not to modify the agreement. This is perceived as necessary because foreign countries found it increasingly difficult to negotiate with the United States because the president's word was not reliable. He would enter an agreement and then Congress would change it. So fast-track authority became the way for the United States to have the president negotiate on behalf of the United States and guarantee that the agreement would either be accepted or not, but would not be changed. The president believed that he needed this authority in order to pursue his trade agenda. In order to get such legislation passed, he needed the support of the Senate Finance Committee. The Senate Finance Committee is the overseeing committee for the trade subcommittee in the Senate. Without their agreement and approval, fast-track authority or trade promotion authority is impossible to achieve. Consequently, the president was responsive, exceedingly responsive, to the members of the Senate Finance Committee. The Senate Finance Committee is dominated by senators from states that have lots of open land and lots of forests, the reason being that tax advantages run typically to such lands, and they make their way to the Senate Finance Committee in order to protect those tax advantages. They also turn out to be the senators, therefore, who are involved in trade, and they are protecting the interests of the U.S. industry, particularly the timber-owning industry. The key member of the committee has been, for the last period, Senator Max Baucus from Montana, but also supported by Larry Craig of Idaho and other senators from states that are important producers of softwood lumber. And this is not mere coincidence. This is a consequence of the structure of the Finance Committee and the presence of the Trade Subcommittee within the Finance Committee. So Max Baucus made it his number one priority the support of the Bush administration on softwood lumber. And in exchange for that, he supported the president's pursuit of trade promotion authority. So the administration became completely subservient, in effect, to the interests of the lumber lobby because of this other political agenda essential in the president's view to how he could accomplish his trade agenda. Therefore, over the subsequent 5 years of battle now, the administration has on every occasion done anything and everything on behalf of the lumber lobby, and really it's a timber and landowning lobby, and to the detriment of Canadian interests. We've seen a succession of determinations from the U.S. agencies defending the interests of the U.S. industry, regardless of what the law said, regardless of what NAFTA panels have said. Canadian victories have been almost without exception from the beginning of the legal dispute, but the United States has used every possible legal device to avoid respecting those decisions and to avoid implementing them.
Let's talk about the numbers just for a second. The U.S. had held approximately $5 billion, is that correct?
Because of the very high rates initially at around 28%, very substantial monies were collected at the beginning. Now, over time, through a process of what's called administrative reviews, the Canadian side has won a series of determinations, even within the agencies, largely consequent to the decisions before the NAFTA panels, and the rates have come down. So now they're around 11% from the original 28. But over that period of time, over $5 billion U.S. has collected in the U.S. Treasury as deposits, cash deposits, on estimated duties. Were the outcome of the litigation process to be that duties were owed, then all of that money would be owed. But the outcome of the litigation process has been very clear. No duties are owed. So those estimates on duties, those cash deposits, are due back to Canadians. And under U.S. law, those deposits have been accumulating interest at a fairly good rate from the beginning. And they're entitled to their money back with interest. There remains a dispute open in court as to whether all money comes back or just money since November 2004 for a fairly complicated legal reason. And we're awaiting a decision on that, very confident of the outcome, very confident. But because of the dealings of the Government of Canada now with the United States to settle the dispute, we're discouraged that the Court of International Trade may not issue that decision, waiting for settlement instead of appearing to interfere again with the political process and with an international negotiation. So we thought we would have had that decision a little while ago. We don't have it yet. We're anxious about it. But that decision would confirm that NAFTA panels have the same authority as U.S. courts, and that when they say that the money was illegally collected, all of it must be returned. The U.S. is operating under a legal theory that in NAFTA, when money is collected illegally, it's not returned until the time when the panel has decided that it was illegal, and then only the money from that time forward is returned, but not the previous money. And that's the November 4, 2004 watershed date. So that last question is critical for all Canadian industry, not just softwood lumber, because were it to be that under NAFTA, the United States gets to keep money it illegally collected, no one would ever use NAFTA again. You could never go to a Chapter 19 panel sensibly. So that decision is very crucial for the survival of NAFTA Chapter 19. We don't have that decision yet. All the briefing's done, the hearing's been had, everything in front of the court is finished, and we know that the court has been kind of holding back, waiting to see what's happening with this agreement. So you have $5.3 billion at stake, and roughly $3 billion of it is not in dispute. The court is clear. There's no doubt that about $3 billion comes back, but the rest remains uncertain with respect to this legal decision.
Well, and $2 billion is a lot of money. Can we discuss a little bit about the two men that negotiated this deal with the United States? One is Frank McKenna, is that correct?
Well, no, that wouldn't be correct. Frank was ambassador to the United States in the Liberal government.
Okay.
And he attempted a negotiation roughly a year ago, a little less, back toward Christmas. And he thought he had an agreement, but he was informed bit by bit by the Canadian industry that he did not have an agreement. And part of what he was negotiating was that he started off on the notion that the United States was going to get 50% of the money that had accumulated. The United States was then operating, both the government and the U.S. industry, on the theory of what was known as the Byrd Amendment, is known as the Byrd Amendment. The Byrd Amendment is a provision of U.S. law that says that duties collected in the U.S. Treasury ultimately go to the U.S. industry that brought the petition that led to the collection of the duties. We challenged that proposition in U.S. court under NAFTA. We said that even if it were possible, and the WTO had already said that this was illegal under international law, we said if it were possible under international law, it was not possible under U.S. law with respect to NAFTA goods, that it was inapplicable both to Canada and to Mexico. And we won that case. On April 7, the Court of International Trade ruled that we were right and that no money could be distributed to the U.S. industry from cash deposits collected on Canadian merchandise. So at the time that Frank McKenna was negotiating at Christmas, the theory had been that the United States might be able to claim all the money and would settle for half. And then the industry had said half's not good enough, and the ratio kept shifting. And ultimately, shortly into the new year, in January, the industry said, no, we can't accept what you're negotiating. So he was not part of the negotiation of this agreement. Notably, however, the Court of International Trade advised the United States on April 7 that it was entitled to no money, and then on April 27, the government of Canada guaranteed the United States $1 billion, $1 billion more than it was entitled to.
So let's break that down just really quickly. Basically, what the court is saying is that the United States is not entitled to any money.
Right.
But in the end, how much money are they going to get under this current agreement?
Under the current agreement, it's an absolute. There's no interest involved or anything. But they are guaranteed $1 billion, broken down, $500 million to the U.S. industry that brought the petition. That's $500 million that they wouldn't have gotten, and they already collected about $13 million from money under Byrd before we brought our case. That was mostly money that came out of the Maritimes because they had not challenged the collection of the money under the anti-dumping order. So it comes, in fact, to about $513 million. And when this was being negotiated, we asked the government to be sure to at least exclude that money, and it declined to do so. So $500 million goes to the direct competitors of Canadian industry. $450 million goes to the White House. $40 million goes into a so-called joint initiative between industry and Canada and United States to promote the use of wood and to achieve some kind of cooperation more globally in the marketplace. And $10 million is set aside to animate the dispute resolution mechanism that's been created and incorporated in the agreement and which will be used principally by the United States.
Okay, so let's go back real quick because you just stated that $450 million is going to go to the White House. Why is $450 million going to the White House?
The original, you have to back into to how this money got divided up. The McKenna negotiation had been about percentages, and he had asked industry, how much do you need? And there were calculations done of net present value, how quickly you would get your money. 70 cents on the dollar today is worth 100% on the dollar 2 years from now. So industry indicated what kinds of percentages it would need or would find acceptable. The new government came in and said, well, we can do 80 cents on the dollar. We can get the U.S. to agree to 80 cents on the dollar. Of course, that was 80 cents on the dollar after there was a court decision that said it should have been 100% on the dollar. So it wasn't a very difficult thing to negotiate to give away 20%, but that's what the government was celebrating as its accomplishment. So at 80 cents on the dollar, the question became, what happens to the other 20%? In the division of the other 20%, the discussions had been a guarantee of some monies to the U.S. competitors. The Canadian industry had in mind a fixed number that wouldn't exceed $150 million as the price of a deal. That became $500 million. And then there was the other $500 million. Always in the Canadian mind was a notion that in the long term, cooperation would be better than these battles, and that cooperation could be achieved if there were a substantial fund of money that would bring the industries and governments all together to work together to increase the demand for wood, to promote its use, to do research on its conservation, to improve the conservation more generally of natural resources, and to create a global market for North American products. And so in the Canadian mind, that joint initiative should have been funded equally by Canada and the United States. When I say the Canadian mind, I mean the industry. Should have been funded equally and should represent a substantial portion of the remaining $500 million. And in the April 27 basic terms of agreement, the language was that there would be this joint initiative and the remainder would go to so-called meritorious initiatives in the United States to be determined by the administration in consultation with the government of Canada. That remainder became, in the course of the negotiations, $450 million, leaving only $40 million for the joint initiative. And that's because the United States, and specifically the White House, said we want most of that money. And Canada, the government, agreed.
So the government, I just want to make this very clear, the government of Canada is going to give the White House, not the U.S. government, not the U.S. Treasury, but the White House and George Bush, $450 million.
The agreement makes no mention of Congress and has no money transferred into the U.S. Treasury. It's structured around escrow funds, and checks are to be written into escrow funds, one for the Coalition for Fair Lumber Imports, the U.S. industry organization that filed the petition and ran the legal cases, one for the joint initiative, which would be $50 million, but 10 is to be immediately carved out of it for the dispute system, and $450 million into an escrow fund that's then transferred under the control of the White House, because it doesn't go to Congress and it doesn't go to the Treasury. And the U.S. government has been very clear that Congress will have nothing to do with any aspect of this agreement, doesn't need to approve it, doesn't need to review it, doesn't need to see it. Of course, under the U.S. Constitution, all monies have to be appropriated by Congress and go through the Treasury, but that's not going to happen, at least as of today, unless somebody changes something. That's not happening in this agreement.
Have you had any contact with any congressmen that are bringing this subject up or questioning the legality of this transfer?
I know that some members of Congress have been advised, and I've not heard of any response of any kind, and I interpret that as meaning that everyone is waiting to see the list, and no one wants to be in a position of forsaking money that might come into their district. Meanwhile, the list was to have been identified, and that verb may turn out to be particularly important, on September 1. The agreement says that the projects are to be identified. It doesn't say announced, or it doesn't say that there's a public announcement. And there was none. And then there was some anticipation at the beginning of this week that maybe there would be when Congress came back to Washington. But there's been no announcement. There's been nothing posted. So it would now appear to me that perhaps there will be none. Canada may or may not, that means the Hopper government, may or may not be aware of the administration's intentions to spend the money. But as of September 1, under the terms of the agreement, the projects were to have been identified, and so the White House is now empowered, under the terms of the agreement, to be telling congressional candidates what they may or may not be able to promise in their campaigns, which is, it appears to me, to be the principal purpose of these funds. So no one in Congress, to my knowledge, has said anything, because I would think that no one in Congress wants to be in a position of appearing to be rejecting money that they might get free money into their district.
This money, $450 million, could that possibly end up in the GOP hands? Is that basically what we're saying here?
No, it doesn't work quite that way, but because it's not going to the party. But when meritorious initiatives were first discussed, the reference, the such as, was Katrina recovery. And the such as, the Katrina recovery, was contemporaneous with the appointment by the president of Karl Rove to be in charge of Katrina recovery. And Karl Rove, of course, is the president's principal political operative responsible for elections. So that reference was not disguised. It was very clear that the money would be used in a political way, but there's been no further identification of the projects per se. What it means is that you don't need to turn the money over to the party. The money is in the hands of a Republican president who's trying desperately to retain his power through a Republican Congress. And the Republican Congress is in considerable difficulty. Page one, above the fold, New York Times 2 days ago, announcing that the Republicans are very concerned that they may lose the House of Representatives. The Republican campaign war chest in the party, it has been around $300 million. This is a 150% addition, not to be used for TV advertising or traditional campaign purposes, but to announce public works. The terms in Article 13A2 of the agreement suggest that meritorious initiatives range everywhere from educational programs to assistance in timberland communities, all the kinds of things that Canadians think they should be receiving, and the Canadian money is going to go to Americans for the purpose. But the Republicans are in particular difficulty in rural districts and in timberland communities, in fact, this fall, and the money is targeted into those districts. Moreover, the money belongs to the Canadian industry, but under the terms of the agreement, the U.S. government will be returning the money slowly to Canada. Canada will advance the $1 billion. The Canadian government will advance the $1 billion to the United States for money that is already in the U.S. Treasury to be returned to Canada. And the interest and so on that money will be paid by Canadian taxpayers.
Right. So the Canadians are going to lose again on that advance of $1 billion. Is that correct?
That's exactly correct.
Okay. I just think it just to put this down into small terms, I mean, if there's about 30 million Canadians and we're transferring $450 million into meritorious initiatives for the U.S. government, that's about $15 per person, man, woman, and child. And we know that perhaps George Bush doesn't have a majority of people here in Canada that are particularly appreciative of some of his policies. Do you think that any of the MPs here in Canada are going to speak up and deny this transfer of money?
Well, you have to break up the conjunction in your sentence. There are a number of MPs who've been speaking up. I guess the most visible about this fund has been so far Peter Julian of the NDP, but Bob Rae, who's not a member of Parliament but who's a candidate for the Liberal leadership, spoke up about a presidential slush fund months ago. I think other members may begin to be more specific and address it as well. So the first part of your sentence, will there be members of Parliament or other prominent Canadians speaking up? There are some now, and maybe there will be more. The second part of your sentence, however, was and deny the transfer, and that's a different political question. The NDP says it will oppose the agreement. The Liberal Party says it will oppose the agreement, but it appears that the Liberal Party is opposing the agreement because they feel assured that the Bloc Québécois will support the agreement and therefore will not bring down the government. Were the Bloc to say next week, no, we won't support the agreement, then I'm not sure what the Liberals will say, since neither the Liberals nor the Bloc feel ready for an election. And the Harper government has quite cleverly made this a confidence vote at a time when the Liberals have not resolved their leadership issues and the Bloc is uncomfortable about going to the polls again. So denying it requires modification of the agreement or outright rejection of it. And I'm not sure Parliament is ready to do that, even though this is indeed the responsibility of the Canadian Parliament.
Okay.
And the Canadian Parliament would be left in the position, in my view, of intruding in American politics in a virtual effort to preserve the power of the American president, which, as you say, given his lack of popularity in Canada, would be at best ironic that the Canadian people, through their parliament, would be actively assisting the president to retain power in a way in which no foreign government has ever done in American history.
Until this year, 2000.